Okay, I have been already discussions here about the general idea of the color graph and some of its applications to heavy ion physics, even animated discussion in the last few weeks. It is not really my intention here to speak any further about possible implications for heavy ion physics and phenomenology of heavy ion physics, especially since there are people in the audience which are much more expert than me on that particular topic. I will just remain on a general level, so I'll try to present to you a physical picture of the color glass and what it is good for. More precisely, I would like to present you some recent progress in the understanding of the high energy limit of scattering in QCD. We are more and more able to say something from first principles, and I want to discuss about that. And since there is a lot of material accumulated in the last few years, and I cannot present everything, even less in detail, I'll try to use as a guidance principle the problem of unitization of deep and massive scattering as Molex. So how the cross section is initialized, how Frasar band is satisfied, eventually because of nonlinear effects related to saturation. So this is essentially the plan of my talk, which is just the main idea which I will follow. I will start by discussing deep and massive scattering as Molex. I will emphasize the difference between single scattering and multiple scattering, and the role of multiple scattering in providing unitization at fixed impact parameter. I will show that it is not enough to have Frasar bound, but one has to look at physics of high gluon densities. This will drive me to the color glass condensate, which I will present as clearly, I hope, as elementary as possible. I'll discuss important consequence of that, which is what is made for to describe gluon saturation, and then I'll show you what are the implications of this phenomenon of Frasar bound. And in fact, one can derive cross section which saturates Frasar bound. Those are a few questions which I would like to address and hopefully to answer in my talk. They're all related to the high energy limit of QCD scattering. And the first question is, can this be ever addressed in perturbation theory? First of all, for suitable reasons, the coupling constant is running with a transferred momentum and not with the total energy. So high energy doesn't mean small coupling. Besides, Frasar bound involves explicitly the mass of the pion, which is certainly non-perturbative. And standard perturbation theory in the form of the BF-Kyle equation, which is some of the most important corrections at high energy, is well known to fail to describe the high energy limit, in that it provides a cross-section which increases the powers of energy with a BF-Kyle intercept times alpha s, which of course varies Frasar bound. Besides, the solution to the BF-Kyle equation has a bad taste to diffuse toward soft momenta with increasing energy, so eventually enters a non-perturbative regime where it's not meant to. Well, if you look at this counter example here, we see that the only one which is really excluding completely perturbation theory, it's Frasar bound, the mass pion mass. The problem with the coupling constant is just a question about scaling the problem, and this is just a difficulty of BF-Kyle approximation by itself. It is obvious that we'll never be able to generate the normalization of the cross section in perturbation theory. On the other hand, the question which one can hopefully address is to study the evolution of the energy within perturbation theory. Like for the Gallup equation, the initial condition remains non-perturbative, but nevertheless the evolution can be addressed in perturbation theory. So that's all we can ever hope to do, and that's what I might talk about.
Here you mean Frasar bound for deep and elastic?
No, for everything. I will never discuss about it. No, the deep elastic is just for everything. For anything which scatters off a target.
So who is Frasar?
It's a guy from Sac Bay, I might. you know who is Frasar?
No.
Marcel Frasar was one of the founders of the theoretical division in Sac Bay in the 50s. He wrote his famous paper while at Berkeley. So in the 60s.
Where did he get his bound from? Is it phenomenology or?
No. It's an expert of scattering theory. So in the same time of André Martin and this English school of Landschaft and so in that time, yeah, scattering. Mandelstam was essentially, she essentially was one of the first prominent uses or utilizations of Mandelstam representation to do something high non-trivial with it. So he used the Frasar bound is a bound, it's not dynamics. It just, ignore that. Relies on general principles of quantum physics like anarchistic and unitarity. So the question,
The reason that m pi appears is just because pi n is the lightest?
I'll come back. Sure, that's definitely. But that will be one of the main talks. Focusing my talk, so that, no, don't worry. So before addressing the construction of a perspective active calculation, one should identify the relevant degrees of freedom at high energy. And these relevant degrees of freedom, as I'll review, but you all know by now, are the small X partons, mostly gluons, which are in a state of high density. And the first hint about what the color glass condensate is meant to be is just the matter made of these small X gluons. But I'll describe that more in what comes. So why the small X gluons are the relevant degrees of freedom? Just imagine a high energy hadron-hadron collision, say in the center of mass frame. The valence quark in the two hadrons have very large energies and velocities close to the speed of light, and they move in opposite directions. So essentially, they go to each other without having the time to overlap and to interact. Rather, the interaction is dominated by those virtual degrees of freedom of both hadrons, which have low longitudinal momenta with a fraction x of the total original momentum of much smaller than one, because those degrees of freedom has large longitudinal wavelengths, and they can overlap both in space and in time to significantly to produce interaction. In fact, in a center of mass energy collision like this one, the dominant collision comes simply from those virtual excitation which are at rest in the center of mass frame. And this is for this excitation, the value of x, the typical value of x, it's inverse proportional to the energy. So small x means large energy. And this is even more obvious in the case of deep elastic scattering, which I consider here in an infinite momentum frame of the target, or Birkin frame, which is a frame where the hadron is moving nearly at the speed of light in the positive z direction, so it is Lorentz contracted like that, while the photon is, with the virtual photon is a standing wave in the original direction, this one. And quite generally, independently of the frame, this process is described by two independent kinematical variables, photon's virtuality and Bjorken x, which is goes like q squared over s. So it's small at large energy. And now, if you just look at the kinematics to identify what is the momenta of the parton here, of the quark inside the hadron, which scatters of the external photon, then you realize that this parton must have a longitudinal momentum, which is half of the longitudinal momentum of the photon, which is a condition of maximum overlapping in space and time. And if you translate that in terms of Feynman x, which is by definition the fraction of the total momentum of the hadron, p, carried by the interacting parton, k, then this simply means that Feynman x must be equal to Birkin x, and therefore much more than one. So from now on, x will be always Feynman x, but in deep elastic scattering, it's the same as Birkin x. Now, you also know that data for the structure for the proton electromagnetic structure function F2, which is measured in deep elastic scattering, shows a rapid increase with energy, essentially the power of energy, that's world feed, and the power here depends upon Q squared, but that's in between this range. And in a QCD improved pattern model, this is associated with an increase in the quark and anti-quark distribution function inside the proton. We also know that the gluon distribution is also extracted, although indirectly, in this process, by studying the quantum evolution of the F2 of the quark distribution with increasing Q squared. Then, at least in leading to this expansion, the gluon distribution, which is the number of gluons per unit rapidity, it's proportional to the logarithmic derivative of F2. This relation is only valid to very high Q squared. Besides, it's strongly affected by next linear order correction. And this theoretical uncertainty gives a large error bars in the extraction of the gluon distribution from the data. But it's pretty sure that for any Q squared of interest, when increasing energy, decreasing x, gluon distribution rises strongly. And we have good reason to expect that on a theoretical basis. That's in agreement with everything we know about quantum evolution in QCD. Because, in fact, at very high energy, the small X partons are predominantly gluons, and they have a large density. Why? Because these partons are produced typically via quantum cascades shown here. So the smallest gluon of interest with the one with momentum k here, so with longitudinal momentum fraction x much more than 1, is typically the final product of radiation of a cascade of this kind, which involves to leading order only gluons, and in which the gluons around rungs are strongly ordered in longitudinal momenta. Note that from now on I use Lightcon vector notations, normal than better than ordinary ones, just because that's more convenient. Is there any need to introduce them to remind you, for instance, what's a plus component and a minus component in a Lightcon kinematics, that the transverse ones, they're just very adapted for the scattering kinematics, because in these notations, the hadron, which moves at the speed of light along the z direction, in tz plane, it moves along the light cone, this means along the x plus direction, and is Lorentz contractors in x minus. So it's a thin disk in x minus moving along the x plus direction. So it has only one big component, which is p plus. And given the dot product in a logical notation, it follows that the energy is k minus, the time is x plus, longitudinal momentum is k plus, longitudinal kinetics x minus, and these are the transverse ones. Let me just use it. So I'll therefore redefine x as being the boost invariant Feynman x, meaning the ratio of the longitudinal momentum in Lycon notations, k plus, over the hadron's longitudinal momentum p plus. And I also use the rapidity as log m1 over x. You see that small x means large rapidity. In fact, the rapidity goes like log m of s. So you should always have that in mind. I'll work most with rapidity because that's the most convenient. So why the most important cascade are those which are strongly ordered? Just because the radiation of a small x hadron, or a small x gluon, means a gluon having a small k plus, is enhanced by 1 over k plus, the standard Bremsch-Taugner enhancement. And when you integrate over the whole rapidity interval for each of these radiations here, you get a factor log m1 over x, which can compensate the smallness of the coupling. You also have a factor 1 over n squared, because you have selected one particular ordering. But when you add over all the possible cascades leading to the same gluon in such a way here, in such a way to get the gluon distribution per new rapidity, this is, of course, the sum of all these cascades, which is an exponential. This simply means that by just summing this kind of radiative evolution, one gets a gluon distribution function which increases exponentially with the rapidity, meaning as the power of the energy. And the proper treatment of that is the Abdieff-Kyle equation, which just resums that in a systematic way, and it gives indeed this exponential increase of the gluon distribution with the power here, which is the Abdieff-Kyle exponent. Now, I also shown here the final attachment of the virtual photon deep active scattering, which scatters over quark, but this quark is typically at high energy produced by a gluon cascade, because radiation is dominated by gluon cascades. So it is therefore interesting to separate out, to factorize this perturbative part of the process, which is completely controlled by leading order QED perturbation theory, from the more complicated a priori evolution governed by QCD dynamics here. And this is most easy achieved by changing the frame using the so-called dipole frame. What's the dipole frame? You just boost the previous frame in such a way to give also the photon a large energy, meaning that the photon now has both longitudinal momentum and energy. And the energy is much larger, original momentum is much larger than virtuality. So it's almost on shell. Still, most of the energy is pushed in the hadron. This is such a way, it is fitted in such a way that before scattering, the photon has just enough energy to fluctuate into quark anti-quark pair, a colored dipole, and then this colored dipole scatters off the gluon field in the hadronic target. In particular, by choosing the frame properly, all this gluon here and the evolutions of these gluons comes from the target wave function, while the photon is simply a QQ bar pair. And from now on, most of my talk will be just concerned by the scattering between a colored dipole and a hadronic target. I just remind you the factorization formula for this process. The deep last scattering cross section, photon, proton, is just a convolution of the wave function for the photon to fluctuate into a QQ bar pair times the cross section for the dipole with size R perp. R perp is the size of the dipole. And energy, tau, rapidity or energy is the same, in units. So this is the quantity I want to compute in what follows. And by itself, this is generally given by from general theory of scattering, by the integral over all the possible impact parameters, B perp, of the corresponding scattering amplitude, which is a function of the photon, sorry, of the dipole transverse size, or if you prefer, resolution, upon its impact parameter, upon its energy. All that is well defined in the limit where the photon has very high energy, and in that limit we can use Eikon approximation to compute the scattering amplitude, which means simply to express the scattering amplitude in terms of the gauge factor, the Wilson lines, which show the effect of the color field here upon the quark and the anti-quark. So the only effect at high energy, as you know, is that the quark and the anti-quark get phase rotated with a phase which is determined by the projection of the target field on the trajectory of the quark and the anti-quark. And since the quark and the anti-quark are left movers, so they're moving in Lycon coordinates along the x minus direction, then the relevant component is A plus. So in any gauge where A plus is non-vanishing, the scattering amplitude is given by this expression.
Now,
yes?
For this formalism to work, the dipole should be frozen as it crosses the
sure.
target. So it must, the size of the target must enter the definition of your frames in some place.
Yes, I mean, any case, my dipole will be always much more than under QCD.
Yeah.
What do you want more than that?
But also, I mean, the coherence length in the process must...
that's the energy.
Yes.
But that's given by the energy of the total energy. Higher the energy, better it is. There's no problem. I mean, the total energy matters.
No, I'm just saying that QZ much bigger than Q does not yet define
No. In fact, I have to be. It doesn't have to be much bigger because it is too big. Then my own dipole starts to radiate. I will have also gluons like that, which I don't want.
Yeah, exactly. So you want.
Sure.
Yeah, so you want two things which are not necessarily compatible with each other. You want to shift all evolution in the Hartmann wave function.
Why? Yes.
Which is what you said. Right?
Yes.
On the other hand, you want the dipole to be frozen during the interaction. So
right.
So there are two things which sort of push the frame, you know, in different directions. So there has to be some.
I'm not introduced that myself. That's a textbook judgment, but I never send discussion on that. But you can discuss. For me, that's just a pretext. I'm only interested in this object here.
Yeah, I think there was a question behind you.
Yes.
No.
It's not your question.
No. Edmond can't see you.
Yeah. Sorry. No, from now on, I'll essentially focus on the hadronic interaction between the dipole and
where
and,
do you get phi from?
Phi is just the squared of the Lightcon wave function of this QQ bar pair, which is a QED perturbation theory. It's Lightcon QED perturbation theory. It's standard. It's a Bessel function. So far, I have only used essentially kinematics to relate the scattering amplitude and the cross section of the dipole to an average over the color field within the hadronic target. And this average, computing this average means treating the QCD scattering, and showing how to do that will be essentially the main part of my talk. But before going into full theory, let me give you just some special limits where some of the physics can be seen, the limits of interest, of physical interest. For instance, assume first that this color field, A plus component of the color field in the hadronic target, have only a single non-trivial correlation, the two-point function. And assume also that the correlation length for this two-point function is sensibly larger than the size of the dipole, which is when a dipole acts as a dipole. When this happens, you might know what happens. The dipole will essentially couple to the electric field. This means if this is a scattering amplitude, scattering potential for the quark and that for the anti-quark, the difference when R perp is small is the size of the dipole times the derivative of the electric potential, which means the electric field. It is for one gluon exchange, but for plenty of reasons, including color symmetry, the scattering involves at least two gluon exchange, like what is displayed here. And therefore, the lowest order scattering amplitude will involve the product of that, meaning a correlator of two electric fields times the area L squared of the dipole. And the correlator of two electric fields is precisely the Fock space definition of the gluon density. The number of gluons per unit of momentum in the Fock space. I can go to more details if you want about that, but you realize when we proceed to quantization of field theory, of a gauge field theory, it's natural to define the number of quanta of the electric field as being the number of elementary excitation in that quanta. So the number of quanta of electric field is a gluon of number, and this is what I called before x g of x. Note that this is a given energy x, given transverse size q squared, and also given impact parameter. So my work as a local impact parameter. So if I perform now the average here of this product of Wilson lines, assuming only a two-point function, the average is trivial to perform, of course, like a Gaussian, it is a Gaussian averaging, and the result of this averaging is this normal exponential here, exponential minus alpha s, a color part which I didn't show, the transverse size squared of the dipole times the gluon distribution. So this is simply to say that a dipole is a direct probe of the gluon number in the hadron wave function. Now, assume the first that we are in a regime where the energy is not too high, so the gluon density is pretty small, or equivalently, the dipole is small enough for this quantity to be much more than one. Then one can expand that to lowest order. That one can just consider one single scattering of any of the gluons in the hadron. This is a formula for scattering amplitude to single scattering approximation. This is just the leading twist, standard leading twist expansion of the lab. And if you assume now the gluon distribution to evolve with increasing energy according to any linear evolution equation like the lab of BFKL, you will find the gluon density which increases very fast, power law in a BFKL case, in such a way that eventually the scattering amplitude at fixed B perp will violate your entirety constraint. Well, of course, but at this level, in this formalism, you already know how to cure that. It's enough to return to this expression. This simply means that when the amplitude is of order 1, you enter the regime of multiple scattering. So one must return here. So in this formalism, you say unitization at fixed coupling, at fixed impact parameter is trivial. It's trivial. It's automatic. So this is, I repeat once again, the formula for multiple scattering, which in terms of twist expansion resumes all orders. You can never see unitization at a finite order in the twist expansion, in the operator product expansion of diplomatic scattering, but the sum of all twists is automatically satisfying the unitarity bound.
Let's see.
Yes?
Just to keep the what's an assumption and what's...
No, that's just kinematics, so for no assumption.
I mean, the previous stuff was just factorization, strict QCD, operator product expansion.
Yeah, but that's all that is standard. That's global formula from the 60s, so I just want to make some basis.
But wait a minute, exponentiating and assuming only the two-point function.
That's assumption. I'll get back to that.
That's an additional assumption.
Sure, assumption. I will discuss my whole talk about when it's not true.
Okay.
Sure. But I just want to give that's the standard picture of unitization, yes? So the question is then, when does multiple scattering become important? Well, obviously when the exponent here is of order 1, which means either high enough energies or large enough dipoles. In terms of the size of the dipole, this happens when the size of the dipole is larger than a critical size, which I call saturation length, which is the inverse of the momentum scale, which I call saturation scale. And this is simply the inverse scale at which this exponent here becomes of order 1. And this is precise definition of saturation scale. I reinserted the appropriate color factor just to have color symmetry explicit. Note that it is not really an explicit expression because Q saturation enters both in the left-hand side and in the right-hand side. The gluon distribution evaluated at Q squared equals Q saturation squared. So it's an implicit equation. But never mind. Just based on that, one can say that Q saturation as a function of the energy or rapidity and as a function of impact parameter B perp has the same behavior loosely speaking, as the gluon distribution, meaning it increases rapidly with the energy, probably as an exponential of the rapidity, as power of the energy, and it decreases with B perp.
The alpha strong here is just a bare parameter.
I mean, it's just fixed. It's just GFK level. Yeah. Sure. Why does that? That's important. Why does the gluon distribution decrease with B perp? Just because we have always a profile of the density in the hadron. The hadron is denser at the middle, and density decreases toward the edge. So it's definitely obvious the case as all the models we have that the density decreases with B perp. So it sure will be all saturation scale. Question?
We had some saturation going on here.
Shadowing. Okay. I hope it's not me. Saturating you.
Amal moved and shadowed me, and then I moved and shadowed Ramona.
Okay.
It's multiple shadowing.
Okay. So let me just go on. So I'll come. The dependence upon B perp will play an essential role for Poisson bound. I anticipate that, but I'm not yet there. I'm still at the level of the dependence upon the energy. So I just show you here plots of this all twist expression for the scattering amplitude as a function of the distance of the size L perp of the dipole and tau as a function of L perp for two energies, for two rapidities, tau 1 and tau 2. In both cases, at very small L perp, n tau goes linear with L perp squared, that's just the leading twist. In this case, n tau is also much more than 1, so in a regime called color transparency here. In both cases, at very large dipole, the scattering amplitude is of order 1, meaning that the dipole is completely absorbed. She just sees a hadron as a black disk, and that's a black disk limit. And the transition between transparency and blackness proceeds as the energy, tau 1, depend upon tau, so at some transverse size air perp, which depends upon the energy, and it is precisely saturation length I shown to you before. Higher is the energy, higher saturation scale, smaller is the saturation length. So you see the transition proceeds faster at smaller air perp, the energy is higher. Higher is the energy, higher is the density of gluons in the hadron, so easier is for a given size dipole to interact. So if this is the given size of the dipole, this dipole will be already saturated at this size for this energy, while we'll be in a regime of color transparency for this energy. Okay? Just elementary facts, but all these elementary facts will be like a pieces of the puzzle at the very end. So either you listen to me up to the end or you missed everything. I have to warn you.
That sounds like a threat.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's up to you if you're interested or not, but that's all. It's a theorem with corollaries and lemmas and all that. So I have to produce all that. So I have been speaking about, you have seen already, multiple scattering gives without any problem unitization of the scattering amplitude as a fixed impact parameter. Now the question is about Poisson bound. Is that, which is a limit on the total cross-section, is that automatically satisfied? The answer is no, because of the edge of the hadron, which is a quantum system, is not sharp. Assume that the hadron had a sharp edge, so being just a disk of hadrons of radius R. Then with increasing energy, eventually all the points in the hadron would become black. And at that moment, the total cross-section would be simply the geometric area of the hadron. But this doesn't happen because the hadron has always an exponential tail. It's a compound object of theory, QCD, which has the smallest mass gap equal to the prior mass. So at any energy, if you make a transverse profile, this is B perp now, of the saturation scale for a given energy as a function of B perp, then we have a kind of Wood-Saxon profile, which is slowly decreasing at the center, and then exponentially decreasing in the tail, with exponential here controlled by the pion mass. It is in fact two pion mass. Why two pion? Just because at high energy you probe mostly the gluons in the hadron wave function. And the gluons are isospin zero. So to scatter off one gluon, you have to change two pions. So in this high energy regime, the tail of the hadron wave function decreases as exponential is B with 2m pi. Now assume that at a given energy, say at the lower energy, tau 2 here, you send a dipole of transverse resolution Q squared. is as long as Q squared. You see, within the hadron, depending upon its impact parameter upon the hadron, this dipole can be completely absorbed or can go through with the more absorptions. Namely, if the impact parameter is very close to the center of the hadron, then Q squared is lower than the local saturation scale. This means multiple scattering are important, which means the scattering amplitude is essentially one. At this point, the dipole is completely absorbed. If, on the other hand, the dipole has a large impact parameter, say here, then the local density is very low. The saturation scale is very low, much lower than Q squared. Then this dipole will only weakly interact. So it will be essentially color transparent. And the limit where the saturation scale becomes equal to the external Q squared, it's just a limit where within which the hadron looks black to that particular dipole. So this is a black disk radius. The black disk radius is the value of the impact parameter up to which the hadron looks black. This depends upon the energy and depends also upon the dipole, because for a smaller dipole, the black disk will be smaller because he is not so strongly absorbed. So the black disk value is a function of energy and of the transverse size. On the other hand, the plot here does not depend upon the transverse, upon the external scale, upon the external probe. This plot, the saturation scale, it's an intrinsic quantity of the hadron. The hadron is characterized by some saturation scale, which decreases with Biparp in this form.
But now, there is also this Z, the photon energy, and the size of the...
I'm speaking for Q squared of the dipole now. Forget about the photon. Now I have just a mega convolution, that's really...
No, let's see, the point is, if for a given R squared, for a given Q squared, you have...
This Q squared is not the Q squared, this is Q squared of the dipole.
What do you mean by Q squared of the
dipole? Forget about the photon. If it's just a given dipole with quarkonium, forget about the photon. That was just a pretext. I just sent a dipole of given Q squared, Q bar.
That's not the deep and elastic Q squared.
I make a convolution at the very end. It's trivial. At that level, it's really trivial. I have a distribution in Q squared, if you could speak in terms of the dipole, which is perfectly controlled by the wave function of the photon. That's perturbation theory.
Right, that kind of changes your argument, but the size of the...
It's yet another variable. There is a Z, right? I mean, the size is 1 over Q squared times Z times 1 over Q.
I agree, but one can make the calculation exactly without any approximation. I know how that everything depends upon Z. But this will be always 1 over R part. What I call here Q squared is the 1 over R part of a given dipole, which is then convoluted with the wave function.
You work at fixed R curve.
Sure, no doubt. But because this is a good quantum number for high-energy scattering, not trivial. But once you set that, then you can work a fixed L-perp. I mean, L-perp is not modified by the crossing of the hadron.
So, yes. The formula I read, so the size of the hadron grows with log s.
Yes.
But the thing in front is controlled by 1 over m pi.
Right.
So, how am I supposed to interpret this in the chiral limit?
Ask Dima, because he has been thinking about that, and he definitely might give a better answer than me. I'm not concerned about that. But Dima, he may answer to this question. He has been thinking about that.
Well, yeah. So
but you ask a deep question. What is a Frassar bound in a theory without mass gap, essentially? But let's don't go to that direction, because it's not my purpose today. I will assume pion mass exists.
So the fact that the pion is... Sort of chiral physics is of no interest to you.
No, I only make...
All you care about, the only reason pion is occurring there is it happens to be the guy who's lightest.
Right. Just by accident. Yes, from my point of view. I agree. So let me just formalize...
The fact that it's a Goldstone boson, or it also goes with irrelevant.
The question, just in short, I mean, this is a very interesting discussion, just in short. This Frassar derivation uses only an analytical property of the amplitude. And the fact you get this e to minus 2 m pi comes from the fact that the cut in the amplitude starts from 2 m pi.
Sure.
But what is most important is that the discontinuity on this cut around 2 m pi can nevertheless vanish. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it should vanish from chiral symmetry. So the actual quantity which enters the cross section should not be m pi, but some other scale. So this is in short b.
But ignoring the prefactors.
But you have to bring in chiral symmetry to arrive to this conclusion. If you just use analyticity alone, which only knows about the beginning of the cut, then you arrive to m pi, which has this divergent limit in the chiral.
Okay. But so you would say that in the chiral limit, that m pi will be the m pi in the Poisson bound is replaced by something else.
Yes.
By what?
Well,
in chiral theory, it will be replaced by something like 4 pi f pi. But, you know, this is the.
Okay, I'm probably 10% of my talk by so far.
But that means, in nature, what should it be? I mean, in nature, should it be 4 pi f pi, which is bigger than
we don't
that?
Know.
It has to be a scale which does not vanish in the chiral limit, because you know that at the cut,
right.
The discontinuity should go like g mu pi squared, so it should vanish.
Should I continue my talk on Friday? Because honestly, I'm 10% of my talk so far. I would prefer not to be any question until the end, except questions which are really necessary to the talk, because I never finish. Yeah, it's a simple solution. No, and no, don't let it become like Minneapolis, you know. You know what?
You need some sort of Russian center.
Yeah. So this is essentially a transcription of the original argument by Heisenberg, which was simply to show that, to say that if quantum evolution with energy going from one energy to a higher energy takes place essentially locally in the impact parameter space, this means it increases in the same way for any bipart, then you have this combination of an exponential increase with rapidity at each bperp and an exponential decrease with bperp, which essentially compensate each other at the value of bperp, the saturation scale, the Black Diels radius, sorry, which increases linearly with log of s, which involves one over m pi. And interestingly, it involves also the BF curve intercept if you accept this evolution to be described by BF curve, but that's just assumption.
Sorry, quick question.
Yes.
The separation you're going to assume to be true at all impact parameters?
I will prove it. So at this level, this is just assumption. And the problem is that, in fact, this is what led people for many years to think that one can never prove Poisson bound in perturbation theory. Is first, the emergence of the parent mass, that's true, trivially non-perturbative, so to say. The second problem is the evolution with the energy. Can this be described or not in perturbation theory? And the problem is that if you look at a normal perturbative equation, the idea is that this involves massless gluons. So although you have started with short-range nuclear forces at initial low energy, just the evolution equation will drive you long-range interactions, which may give you Coulomb tails, which may spoil this initial exponential decrease. So one generally one formalizes that by saying that perturbation theory can never describe the evolution at very high energy. My claim today will be to show that although I cannot never describe the initial condition, so the initial condition I don't want to speak about 2m pi, 5m pi, 4 pi, f pi, I don't care. But assuming an exponential decrease here, I can control the perturbative evolution, and this perturbative evolution is of this kind. And leading, so the dependence upon s. It may be controlled by perturbation theory, leading to Poisson bound saturation. Although the initial condition, which is the coefficient in front of the logarithm of S, is completely non-perturbative, for sure. But the problem about evolution. So let me just make a cartoon with the same, just probably the same picture, but with also the hadron picture. So this is a black disk corresponding to some given external probe. The external probe is a dipole. You see, the two axes here, the quark and the anti-quark, that's a transverse cross-section of the hadron. So the dipole is coming like that. At the impact parameter B, which is large enough for the local saturation scale to be much larger in momentum than the resolution, much larger in a coordinate than the transverse size of the dipole, meaning that the dipole is very energetic, has a large Q squared. So such a small dipole is not completely absorbed. It is in a gray area. And this is translated in the fact that corresponding to it, you see, Q squared versus the saturation scale at the impact parameter, at the actual impact parameter, which is here, probably there, let's say, or here probably, the Q squared is much larger than the local saturation scale. On the other hand, if the impact parameter was much smaller, say here, then the local saturation scale, which has been above the Q squared of the dipole, and so the dipole has been completely absorbed. So the physics of the flutter bound is essentially the physics of the extension of the black disk with increasing energy. One can essentially demonstrate that the total cross section at very high energy is dominated by the black disk area. Yes?
When Alex Kottner was here.
Yeah, I know. I'll precisely disprove the arguments. So, any other question?
I didn't say anything. When Alex Kottner was here, he was arguing that the way you should see a proton is three little black disks. Instead of one at high energy, instead of one black disk, three little black disks.
Well, ask him about that. I don't agree with that, and I don't understand it. So let's. It's a way to justify things he doesn't like. So no. Let me. I have no two black disks. I have only one black disk. I have one gray area. This black disk expands linearly with rapidity, as I show in a moment. And it will give me plus out.
Can you explain?
That's the final result. I'll try to explain that in my talk if you let me.
Can you explain what the difference is? I mean, these pictures.
Sure.
Only...
Sure. Precisely. My left transparency is about that, but there's 20 transparencies on one. Sure. But to understand that, you have to understand the physics of the gluons inside here. So you see, what is the problem that Kovner was worrying about? Higher is the energy, larger is the black disk, more gluons get accumulated here. The density of these gluons is not decreasing exponentially with distance any longer because they're saturated. So the color charge increases. Being a large color charge here, this produces a strong Coulomb field outside. So you have a large distance Coulomb tail somewhere here. This means that the dipole coming a priori in the gray area, it scatters not only upon the local sources around here, but also via the long-range Coulomb tails, it scatters upon the color sources here. And if this happens, then at sufficiently high energy, the scattering can be shown. Scattering is dominated by the color sources within the black disk, and then the black disk expands exponentially. The nofos are bound. But precisely, I want to show that it does not happen. The scattering is dominated, so that's the difference between Kovner. Black disk is irrelevant for the scattering of a small dipole coming here in the gray area. The dominant scattering to the small dipole comes from the nearby color sources. That's exactly the difference from me and Kovner. Okay?
Isn't that because you introduced this e to the minus n pi?
No. That's the initial condition, of course.
That was his whole argument. If you introduce.
No. I can come. That's to do. His whole argument was about the lack of the m pi in the evolution equations. Nothing to do. I have no evolution equation with m pi in it. My gluons are massless. Sure.
You introduced it as an outside.
No, forget that. Read his paper. No, his paper is very clear. He says that as long as the gluons in the perturbative evolution are massless, there is no Fassard bound because eventually the initial m pi doesn't matter because this black disk expands exponentially.
So, Alex,
come on, I am working on that problem. Come on, touch it.
He argues exactly that if you introduce this effective mass...
I can give you the paper. We'll discuss about the paper in front. His argument, if you introduce the mass in the gluon, this evolution... Let me...
I'm trying to ask a simple question, which is, did Alex say that the
Poisson bound
was violated?
Simply. She was saying that whatever is the initial condition given by God, increasing energy automatically in the perturbative context automatically drives you to exponential increasing cross section. So perturbation theory can never describe Poisson bound.
That was what Alex said.
Whatever the initial condition, even infinite minus top mark, not empire.
But then Alex had a way of describing.
I know, I'll discuss that. I will contradict his picture. I want to show that indeed the evolution described by perturbation theory cured that. Because of gluon saturation effect, because of non-linear effect in gluon in the evolution. That's my point. This work has never been presented before. That's the first seminar on that topic. So that's why you cannot look at that in my papers. There's no paper, but it will going to be one very short.
No, I've seen it in Larry's, that's why.
Well, you have seen it in Larry's, but then you haven't read it. I'm sorry. I will discuss about that. I'll discuss my view against the Kovner's point.
Please.
Thanks. So the question is, nice picture. That was made by Larry, by the way. Larry has to do something. I mean, at this level, he's just, in the process of writing the papers, he's getting both UI pictures.
Larry works in a large NC limit, if you notice his pictures, there's always more than three colors in his pictures.
For very normal limit, for, no, there are eight.
Look at
there are eight.
Eight colors.
Sure, because we think, there is no quark here, there's only gluons.
So eight colors.
Only gluons, no quarks of small x.
He's also following all the talks of Brookhaven on the internet.
Yeah, no, that's Larry's talk. Okay, so the problem is, in fact, already Krishna revealed the problem. The problem, also Jamal, the problem is related to the physics of the saturated gluons inside the black disk. If I keep accumulating here a color source without any new physics, then definitely this huge color source will give me strong Coulomb tails, which will break eventually Frassar bound. So I have to better understand the physics at high density in the black disk in order to see what can still save Frassar bound. In this
so that comes to your factorization of impact parameters.
I will demonstrate that. I have the full equation, the same equation, Balinski-Kochel equation that everyone is using. And on based on that, I will demonstrate that at any energy. That's the initial condition of factorization. I will demonstrate. You see, just take, you see, tau naught. Tau equal tau zero. That's the initial condition. Then this will be the final proof of the evolution at high energy.
But it's the same color as Kravitz has to eliminate in his
life. Right. I'll show that. Quantum evolution does that for me. Of course, Kravitz and Venugopalan, they're using three-level distributions without color neutrality. Quantum evolution does the same for me.
But they have to do it by hand somehow.
Because they have no quantum evolution. Of course not. How could they? That initial condition. In that case, they have only classical fields. So the question is, what happens with the density or the high density gluons within the black disk? And that's, from now I will skip for a while to only study the evolution of the gluons in the high density regime. No dipole, just hadron. So I just increase the energy, and this is a view of pictorial view of the hadron. At some energy, and that's a pictorial view of the same hadron with the same transverse resolution Q squared, but at higher energy. I have more and more gluons there. These gluons start overlapping the transverse plane, and they start interacting with each other. This means that the gluons coming from separate cascades may fuse and give a smaller final density. And once the radiation of new gluons is compensated by the combination from different gluons cascades, we get a regime of saturation, which has been proposed first time long time ago. Now, this gentleman also have given a simple criterion about when the nonlinear effect in the gluon evolution should become important. And this is simply when the scattering amplitude, the scattering probability between two gluons, which is a product of the scattering cross-section for gluons of typical momentum Q squared, times the gluon density with that transverse size Q squared at that energy X and at the given impact parameter B perp, is of order 1. And if you look at this expression, you see that this happens if Q squared is smaller than some critical value, which I call Q saturation squared, as a function of energy and of B perp, which is determined by this condition. I mean, mainly this is one for Q equal QS. And this condition is the same as I had before for the importance of multiple scattering. This simply means that multiple scattering in the dipole cross-section becomes important at the cell scale where saturation becomes important in the Hadron wave function. The two processes cannot be distinguished one from the other. So what I say here, unitization of the local scattering amplitude for a coming dipole is the same as saturation of the smallest gluon in the Hadron wave function. This also shows that in the regime where multiple scattering becomes important, I'm automatically in a regime where nonlinear effects are important too. So if nonlinear effects are important too, it means that my assumption before that the scattering of the dipole is controlled by just the two-point function, or by the gluon distribution, fails. It means that the formula Glauber-Müller never applies. Either the exponent is small and they have leading twist, or the exponent is large and then you forget about it. Okay? So then what do you replace? By what do you replace the Glauber formula at a very high energy? That's my purpose, to explain that. The first observation, the first question is how to compute in such a high nonlinear regime. What is helpful is that the typical momenta for the high density gluons are of the order saturation scale. So they're rapidly increasing with the energy as an exponential of the rapidity. They're also increasing with the number of nucleons in a hadron. So if the energy is large, or the number of hadron, the nucleons is large, A number is large for a nucleus, then automatically Q saturation squared is large, and the coupling constant as evaluated at saturation scale is small. This means we can rely on weak coupling methods. Not standard perturbation theory, because we need resummations to all orders, but we can rely on weak coupling methods. That's very useful. And the next step, done by Larry and Raju Venkatakrishnan a long time ago, is to observe that because we're in a regime of high occupation numbers, of order 1 over alpha s, I'll come to that later, we're in a semi-classical domain, where you can treat the smallest gluons in a first approximation as classical fields. This model by Larry and Raju, it's mostly seen as an effective theory, and I'll show you why. It's an effective theory valid at a given scale, at a given k plus. And in this effective theory, all the partons, the gluons with larger p plus in the gluon cascade can be replaced by a color charge distribution. Out of it, the least smallest gluon is emitted. And the property of this color charge distribution are to a large extent determined by kinematics. Namely, since it is due to very rapidly moving partons with large p plus, this color charge is Lorentz contracted in the Lycon. It's essentially a delta function in x minus. Furthermore, it is frozen. It's no dependence upon the Lycon time x plus. Why? Because these partons here are moving at very high velocity as compared to that one there. So in the rest frame of the later, this here look as Lorentz time dilated. So the typical time for dynamics in this for these partons is much larger than the typical lifetime of the last gluon here. So during his short lifetime, he cannot see any dynamics here. He only see a color charge, a frozen color charge. And this is essential because this explains why we can have not to worry about quantum coherence between different configurations of the color source. This small X gluon only see one given configuration, so he's blind to quantum interference effects. Because of that, we can treat this as a color, as a classical color source. And because of that, we can treat that as a classical random variable with just a classical probability distribution. So in brief, in order to compute any correlation function in this effective theory, one has first to solve a classical Jannius equation with this specific source. And then once we have the solution, okay, we wrote it here with curly letters, one has just to average for the endpoint function of interest, let's say two-point function here of the electric field, one should just have to average over all the possible configurations of rho with a weight function, which I call, it's a function of rho, W of rho, which is determined fully by the dynamics of the fast partons there. It's just a probability to have a given configuration there. So treating the quantum dynamics properly here, we give us the weight function. And then with this weight function, we'll be able to compute the averages there.
Well, yep. I have a technical question. In this picture, all the sources rho are independent, right?
No, of course not. Of course not. That would give me faster bound. Of course not.
No,
I mean, this contains any correlations.
No, but you have...
No, forget about the Raju's model. I don't speak about Raju's model.
Okay, you're not talking about
it. Of course not. That we'll never get a faster bound in Raju's model in classical theory. You need quantum evolution. The point is that I will come up with Raju's model also, just as an example. But the point is that this weight function is computed by summing over all the radiation effects here, even also including fusion among gluon cascades.
I thought I was going to say that even quantum evolution is not going to give you the correlations which are built into exponential for law.
Of course not.
Because from this you have to build fines.
Of course not. Definitely that will be
not built in the evolution.
Definitely. So that the exponential for law is and will remain forever my initial condition. At low energy, I take that for non-perturbative physics. And then I apply to that initial condition perturbative evolution. I already pretend that perturbative evolution does not break down the exponential fall off. That's all.
Well,
yep.
Do I dare?
Please. You're an organizer, so.
the whole point of talk here is there should be lots of time for questions throughout. So.
Sure, no, I agree.
And not only from organizers.
No, I'm sorry for that, but I don't know. At the same time, it's a structure like that.
So, in this picture, whether it's Raju's picture or your picture,
yeah.
In this picture where you talk about classical color field,
yeah.
One of the things we know about before these hadrons arrived, one of the things we know about the vacuum is that in the vacuum there are quite non-trivial color field configurations. Call them incitrons if you like. Call them the color fields are fluctuating and non-trivial in the vacuum. Where?
They are not here.
Yeah, that's. Is there a way of adding it? I mean, is that?
No. I'll can tell you why they are not here.
Let me give the answer.
The only quantum field fluctuation we will be included in this quantum evolution will be those which are normal perturbative fluctuation enhanced by a large logarithm of rapidity of energy. Yes. So if you compute independent diagrams, all the diagrams which are included here, Feynman diagrams, have powers of logarithm of f. So of course, it's not the case for the instanton fluctuations. All the perturbative fluctuations which have no logarithmic enhancement were not included here.
But also all the non-perturbative fluctuations in the vacuum.
Sure, I can't agree more. But it's a physics about high energy in perturbation theory. So my claim is not about QCD. My claim is that perturbation theory for QCD at high energy gives Quasar bound. It's a different statement. Let me just mention that in order to be able to compute anything in the nonlinear GMAT saturation, one has to be able to solve this equation exactly, because you're in a regime where the fields are strong. Gluon density of order 1 over alpha s means color field of order 1 over g. So one has to solve that exactly, but that can be done. I give you a solution, because running out of time, but why is that? Just because what we're after here, we're after about the Weizsäcker-Williams film of a very rapidly moving charge. In that case, it's a fast partons which gives us right to the soft gluons, but that's just a non-Abelian generalization of a standard Weizsäcker-Williams field. I mean, if you start with a Coulomb charge in its rest frame, say an electric charge, it has only radial color field surrounding it. But if you start boosting that to higher and higher energy, then the longitudinal component of the electric field gets squeezed, and magnetic components start developing because of the velocity. And eventually, in the infinite momentum frame, we have a picture where the propagating charge emits a plane wave configuration with electric and magnetic fields only the transverse plane and transverse with respect to each other and equal in magnitude. And that's valid for the Abelian approximation. That's also valid for the non-Abelian case. The only difference is that in this case, of course, the electric field, which is also magnetic field, equal magnetic field, it's non-linear functional of the source because you have to solve a non-Abelian Niemann equation. And this is the expression here. The electric field depends upon the source via the Wilson line built out of the Coulomb field of the source. So you start with a given source, you solve the two-dimensional Coulomb field problem, you get a Coulomb field alpha, then you build Wilson lines with alpha, and it gives you the electric field. And once you know the electric field, you can compute the number of quanta, whatever you like.
You have infinite energy theory.
No, everything is controlled.
Delta functions.
Oh, sure, but that's just for picture. Of course, in the equation, I have no delta function. I agree. I agree. This cartoon is for infinite energy. I agree. Well, everything is relative. Because you see, the question is who is scattering of this wave? It's always an external probe with smaller energy, with higher energy, with smaller x. So always the external probe, this is an effective theory. It's built at a given energy, and it's used at higher energies always. So from the point of view of the external probe, which has a large wavelength, it's like a delta function. But of course, what you mean by delta function is updated step by step in the quantum evolution. I had prepared a transparency to show why do I call this state of high density gluons as a color glass condensate, and why a color glass? It's just by analogy with a spin glass. But probably I should skip that to go to
yes.
The yes to does not. You all know what a spin glass is. This is a color glass. There you
go. We want Froissart.
We have Froissart. Okay. So to see Froissart, you need quantum evolution, right? So the question is, how do you ever determine this weight function? At low energy, you can use, as long as the energy is low enough, you can use a model, like Larry's and Raju's model. In the model, they only consider they only consider color sources which are valence patterns. And valence patterns are statistically independent, just because of Fred's argument, they don't touch with each other in original direction. They're contracted. Because of that, you can say that the color sources at the tree level of the quantum evolution, which are the valence patterns, are completely independent, statistically decorrelated. So they're just a density times a delta function in three-dimensional delta function. And this complete lack of correlations, which would, of course, lead to violation of Fassard bound, has to be contrasted with the correlation which will get built via the quantum evolution, which eventually will give me Fassard bound. So now I come to quantum evolution. But, what does it mean quantum evolution? It means that we need to compute the weight function for the effective theory as the rapidity scale of interest. I mean, as a scale k plus of interest. To this aim, a randomization group analysis has been developed in 1997 by Jamal and collaborators, where at each step one includes a new layer of quantum modes in P plus. So if you assume, for instance, that all the partons above K plus has been already included in the source rho at the scale K plus, then in order to determine the new source rho prime at the scale BK plus, you have to renormalize the previous source by one more additional quantum fluctuations. And this gentleman has also shown that if you do that in the linear approximation, then what you generate is precisely the BFKL equation. So at this level, the resummation of gluon cascades across this classical color source, it's equivalent to BFKL, as it should. Now, of course, we're not interested just in that. We're interested in the nonlinear evolution. We're interested in the fusion between different pattern cascades. To do that, we just observe that when the left gluon is emitted here, it's propagating in a strong color field, the strong field emitted by the source at the previous steps. So since this field is strong, one cannot neglect it in perturbation. One cannot develop in perturbation theory. One has to include it to all orders. That is, one has to replace the standard one-loop BFKL calculation by one-loop background field calculation with the background field resummed to all orders. And this is technically complicated, but has been done after many years of work. And once this calculation is done, there's a second step to be done, which is to show that the original color source plus quantum fluctuation calculated in this way is entirely equivalent from the point of view of all the observables you can compute, any correlation you can compute, with a modified source rho prime with a new weight function at the new scale BK plus. So you have a quantum correlation to calculate and then a matching problem to solve. And once you did that, you can show indeed that the result of this nonlinear evolution equation can be put in an evolution of the weight function, that is, evolution of the probability for having a configuration, or in other terms, in the evolution of all the correlations for rho. And this generates correlations. And I just show you here a typical diagram which is designed in this way, so that the ensuing source at the scale K plus includes not only direct ladders, but also ladder fusions to all orders. That's the resummation that we are aiming after. And the result of this evolution can be summarized in a relatively simple equation, which is a diffusion equation in a functional space. So it's a functional equation because it's an equation for the probability to having a given configuration rho. I will not work with rho. If the equation looks simpler, if instead of working with rho, we work with the Coulomb field alpha. So alpha is just the Coulomb field created by rho to linear equation. So it's a linear relation between the two. So this weight function to have a given color field alpha with increasing energy or rapidity evolves according to the following equation. It's a second order functional differential equation with a kernel, which is itself a function of the gauge field. And it's a functional in this way. It involves a transverse kernel, which is the same as for BFKL equation. And it involves Wilson lines. The Wilson lines made up of the field alpha here. So this is nonlinear to all orders in alpha. But if you expand the Wilson line to lowest order in alpha, you get BFKL. So this is a gauge invariant nonlinear generalization of the BFKL Hamiltonian. And it's obviously a diffusion equation for the probability distribution, means a functional Fokker Planck. It is a Fokker Planck equation by definition, because it describes the evolution of a probability distribution. And it has the right properties to be a Fokker Planck equation. But this functional equation can be also used to derive ordinary evolution equation for the observables. Just remember the dipole example where you have the scattering amplitude involved in two Wilson lines. This average was defined as integral over alpha with the probability distribution W of alpha and the operator. Now, to take an evolution of that observable, you take a derivative with respect to energy, to tau. The derivative acts on the weight function. Here you can use the equation from here. You can perform a few integration by parts with respect to alpha, and eventually you get an evolution equation for this object alone. Well, not alone, because you will get an I ratio of equation. Because this equation being non-linear, the endpoint function of the Wilson line will all get coupled with each other. So this functional evolution equation is equivalent to an infinite I ratio of equation for the endpoint function of the Wilson line. And this is precisely the same I ratio which has been obtained completely independently in a different framework by Balinski. And in particular, limit, the Lagrangian limit is only one equation obtained by Kovchekov. And Herbert Weigert showed 1 year ago that one can rewrite Balinski's equation in a functional form similar to that. I will not comment any longer on that because I want to go to Froissart. So to get to Froissart, you need to know something about the prediction of this equation at very small k perp in the saturation regime. So you need to solve this equation in that regime, and you need to see how correlations get built. So I'll just show you show the result of this evolution without derivation. So the result is the following. They can be obtained, I mean, one can obtain approximate solution to this evolution equation via mean field approximation, which I don't want to discuss now, but the result is the following. Start with the initial condition for the two-point function of the color sources without any correlations. So it was like the McLaren-Venugopalan model, just density independent of k-perp means there is no dependence upon the energy, no evolution, there is no correlation at all. Once you increase the energy, tau, but such that the saturation scale, which increases exponentially with rapidity, remains nevertheless below the k-perp of interest, then you are in a high momentum regime. This means you are in a low density regime, described by normal perturbation theory. And indeed, the general equation just reduces the BFKL in that regime, and BFKL gives us a two-point function of the color sources, which increases rapidly with rapidity, exponentially, times a function of k-perp, slowly varying, but nevertheless, it's k-perp here, which means that transverse correlations get built up. So far, this is just a normal BFKL correlations. But now, assume that you increase energy even faster, such a way that the saturation scale becomes much stronger than k-perp. Then what happens is that the Wilson lines, the density is high, the color fields are strong, and the Wilson line are exponential of strong color fields. Therefore, the Wilson line rapidly oscillates, and they average away to zero. So stronger is the field, smaller is the effect of the field in a way on the physics. This is like a duality argument. That's just because if you look at this equation, which I had before, yes, it's here, you realize that the expansion parameter is not the same at low density or at high density. At low density, fields are weak. Fields are weak. So the expansion parameter is a small field here. You just expand the Wilson lines in power of alpha. To lowest order, you get BFKL. At high energy, the expansion parameter is the Wilson line by itself. The Wilson line is small. So to lowest approximation, you just forget everything from here on, and you get just a free diffusion with a non-trivial kernel, which has nothing to do by itself with the BFKL kernel, because BFKL kernel was obtained by convoluting this with the expansion coming of that. And this in this new kernel is precisely the Coulomb kernel written in a complicated way. If you perform the integral over Z perp here without any Wilson line, this is just the Fourier transform of Coulomb potential in two dimensions. So this means that Coulomb correlations get built up in this high density regime. And this explains my last formula in this transparent, which is the correlation function of the color sources at small k-perp. It's just k-perp squared, the Coulomb, expected Coulomb factor, times the evolution time, if you want, because it's free Brownian motion. So Brownian motion means the two-point function grows like time. Time is rapidity in this case. It's time minus initial tau bar, which is just the critical value when I go from this domain to that domain. So this is a critical rapidity at which k-perp becomes saturated. From this rapidity on, I'm in a saturated regime, and this is the correlation function which gets built. And the fundamental impact of this formula for Froissart, this implies color neutrality. The saturated gluons have zero overall color charge. The average value of Q squared is zero, not only of Q, of course. And this color neutrality is achieved over a scale which is one of the QS, which is a small scale. in the high energy domain, because a very high energy saturation scale is large, one of QS is small, it's a hard scale.
Why so, is that one over QS rather than lambda QC?
Because, simply, because this is the, when this quantum neutrality appears when I can replace the full kernel here by all that, by I can replace all the Wilson line there, by only that part. So this is quite when all the Wilson lines here are small. But the QS is precisely the correlation length for this. By construction, I built my QS in such a way that to be the correlation length of that, because this is a scale which controls nonlinear effects there. But by I just look at the equation, it's obvious that nonlinear effects are controlled by the Wilson lines. So QS is by definition the correlation length for that. So if QS, if K perp is much more than QS, automatically the Wilson lines can be neglected. So this is a scale at which I can neglect correlation Wilson lines. So this is the scale at which I get only the Coulomb kernel. So this is not automatic.
Where's the impact parameter?
Oh, I'll show you. Not so far. So in this, all these analysis, I use no impact parameter. Now I go to impact parameter to go for myself.
Before you go on, can you explain in a couple of words what is the approximation that you're using here? You said it's the approximate solution.
It's very well controlled. In fact, this approximation here is much better shaped than BFKL at high momentum. Because to get to BFKL, you have to neglect something. You neglect higher order effect in alpha in this expansion. Linear order is BFKL. But in the saturation regime, the black this limit holds very well. Means that this object is really zero. I mean, your scattering amplitude n is very close to one. So assuming
the approximation is an expansion in V.
Right, which fits perfectly well close to the black this limit.
The argument that when the field becomes strong, this oscillates so fast that
yes.
You can use it as a small parameter.
Right, and if you look to any numerical solution for V, the Dagger, you see that it's close to one. As soon as you get above saturation scale, it's close to one. So it's even much better than BFKL for the same equation.
Things become simple, trivial.
Sure, that's duality. The physics come through Wilson lines. Wilson lines are small, you have free diffusion.
So the color class condensate is really trivial.
It's a Coulomb gas, I always tell that. It's a Coulomb gas. Yeah, look in my papers. It's a Coulomb gas, know what it is. So just a plot to show gluon saturation before, but you already anticipate that. That's the gluon density per unit of phase space, which is essentially the two-point function of the electric field, or the Coriolis suite divided by K per squared. So this is simply proportional to the rapidity interval for evolution in this Brownian motion regime, so it's the time of evolution. And if you go from time to momenta K perp, you just get 1 over alpha s times the logarithm of Q saturation squared over K perp squared, which is this. You have saturation in the sense that the gluon distribution increases only logarithmically with time, with energy, as a linear power of tau, instead of power like BFKL behavior. It has importance consequences like geometric scaling, which has been observed at F2 data at HERA, which I have no time to describe now. But you may ask about geometric, it's a very nice observation, geometric scaling by itself. So now I finally return to my Poisson bound. So the question I would like to discuss is, can perturbative evolution preserve the exponential fall-off of the given initial non-perturbative condition? Meaning, now I have a nonlinear evolution equation for the scattering amplitude of the dipole. I know how it evolves perturbatively, but in the high-density regime. And I start with the initial condition, which has this exponential fall-off for whatever non-perturbative physics is giving me. My question is, can evolution at high energy tau preserve that? The problem to not to have that would have been related to the existence of massless gluons, as pointed out by Comden and Wiedemann. Now, let me make a few points before going to the argument. First, at high energy, the cross-section is dominated by the black disk, meaning that the total cross-section of the dipole at very high tau is essentially the area of the black disk. That's easy to show. Second, the expansion of the black disk is controlled by the scattering which takes place within the gray area, I mean outside the black disk. It is trivial. I mean, in order for the black disk to expand, you need more scattering outside the black disk. Now, the main point, which you prove on the basis of this nonlinear equation, which I'll explain to you physically in a moment, is that the scattering in the gray area is dominated by color sources at location Z perp relatively close to the impact parameter of the incoming dipole. In such a way that Z perp minus B perp is typically below one saturation length, which by itself is much, much smaller and high energy than the typical scale for inhomogeneity of the initial condition, which is 1 over m pi or 1 over lambda QCD or whatever. It's a non-soft, non-perturbative scale. So it everything proceeds like if the evolution would take place locally in BPERP. So if it takes place locally in BPERP, you can just factorize it out. This means that the BPERP dependence of the actual solution is to a very good approximation given fixed by the initial condition. And the evolution only modifies the prefactor. And in this regime, of course, the prefactor evolves according to BFKL equation. Why BFKL? Because this is the evolution within the gray disk. In the gray area. In the gray area, density is low, so the general equation reduces to BFKL. So we know this function. It's exponential of omega alpha s tau. We know that one. We get Frasser bound. So let me just give you my less transparent and qualitative argument for why this is true. So I just want to emphasize that in order to have this feature, color neutrality of saturated gluons is crucial. And color neutrality is indeed given by the equation I showed to you before. So to show why this is crucial, you remember I had a picture with a black disk. I'm afraid I cannot really find it now any longer. But yes, I did. Oh, well, I only found the support of it. Never mind. I should have put that aside.
Don't worry, I have a good picture of a black disk in mine.
Perfect, I found mine.
But I don't understand this physics.
So assume that you're looking at the scattering of a small dipole in the gray area. This dipole can scatter force of both on color sources around it, for instance, within a saturation length, or of color sources which are far away from it. Now, assume that, as I shown to you before, these color sources here are globally color neutral. This means that the color sources here have mechanically globally a dipole. So my interaction between this dipole and the color sources here is a dipole-dipole scattering. Dipole-dipole scattering in two dimensions goes down like 1 over B-fourth. Because the color field of a dipole goes like 1 over R, and the dipole probes another dipole, makes 1 over R squared for one gluon exchange, and when you have two gluon exchange, 1 over B-fourth. So this short-range interaction is rapidly going down like 1 over B-fourth. This is not exponential, but that's good enough, because on the other hand, the density of the gluon sources here is not increased exponentially neither. Only here increases exponentially. Here is saturated. So here's density of the sources increases as logarithm of S, and the interaction between them, this and that decreases as 1 over B fourth. And that's good enough, I show you now, to provide the Frasser bound. So I have the sum, typically two contributions to the scattering. So short-range interaction within the saturation disk, which I have normal perturbative evolution, exponential increase with rapidity, exponential decrease with B. And I have long-range scattering, where that purpose, the source I scatter off, is in the black disk. And this is dipole-dipole interaction, so it's 1 over B-fourth times the area of one dipole times the area of the second dipole. And now I want that this whole sum here becomes of order 1 when B is of the order of black disk, because that's the scattering condition will determine the black disk radius. The only way to given these variations here, the only way to achieve this condition is that the first term is dominating, so for the one itself, and the second one is negligible. And then if the first one is dominating, then automatically this gives a black disk radius whose increase is linear with rapidity, logarithm of S, and who is determined by the pion mass from the non-perturbative side of the initial condition, and by the BFKL intercept from the perturbative side of the evolution. Note, interestingly, that the role of the BFKL intercept turns out to be not to provide the leading Pomeroy intercept at high energy, but rather to give the coefficient in front of the logarithm of S at high energy. Now, let me give you as a counterexample what would have happened if my color sources in the black disk, although saturated, would have been not color neutral, with a scenario invoked by Kovner and Wiedemann wrongly, because they're obviously color neutral. But they said, oh, okay, there is no transverse correlation. So these color sources have a color charge, mu. So there is no correlation at all. It does not vanish when k goes to zero. Then by using this kind of two-point function for the color sources, one can easily show that this contribution of the dipole-dipole interaction gets replaced by a contribution of a dipole-Coulomb interaction, which only goes down like 1 over b squared. The rest is the same. So 1 over b squared instead of 1 over b fourth. then, and this is a formula which appears in the paper of Conrad Wiedemann, essentially. Then, if this happens, then we have the sum of that contribution and that one. You can easily realize that the only way how can satisfy the condition of having one scattering amplitude at the black disk radius is that the second contribution dominate over the first one, and in such a way that the black disk radius squared expand exponentially with rapidity, means at the power of the energy. So you have no Farisau bound. So color, both saturation, which means that the two-point function of the color sources is independent of energy. It does not go up any longer. So the saturation, but also color neutrality, which tells you that it is not a constant, but it vanishes as Q squared goes to zero, like Q squared. They're both essential to get Farisau bound. That's all. Thank you.
Since color neutrality of the black disk part plays such a big role in your argument, let me ask about that. I understand that color neutrality has to be satisfied over the whole thing, that is black disk.
One over QS. So I answer the question. So when I say what is the relevant scale for the, as soon as black disk expands.
Hang on. I'd like to hear the question.
Okay, I know the question, but anyway.
You may know the question, but we don't, so I'd like to.
So my question is that what a color neutral is, the nucleus or whatever, you subdivide it into a black disk part and a gray part.
Right.
And you say not only the whole nucleus is color neutral, but the black disk part by itself is color neutral. Why?
More than that.
You take the black disk and cut it up in little pieces.
One over QS.
Exactly. Each little piece is color neutral.
Yes.
Why? You said it's obviously true. It was not obvious to me.
Okay. That now I can answer because I got a question. I had all my time. So I get back to the evolution equation. Right. So the question is when how the correlation gets built up with increasing energy. The correlation I'm interested in, which shows that I have color neutrality, are given by this term here alone, by the one, if you prefer, from here.
Don't you first have to tell us how you got this equation? Is this obvious, this equation?
Oh, no, 3 years of work.
3 years of work.
Okay, so forget about it. I mean, 3 years of our work on computing this object by itself, but before us, Jamal and collaborators have been working many years to get to an equation like that. So it's many people working, and the computation of that guy was really technical, and I prefer not to speak about it today because that would be a seminar by itself. But if they, the derivation coming from the point of view of Balinski, although it doesn't seem simpler, if you look at Young's papers, it is actually simpler. So you may prefer to learn from the other side, from the side of view of the evolution of the observables, not from the point of view of the evolution of the wave function, which I prefer. So anyway, to return to Ulrich's question. So this equation would involve the same kind of transverse correlation as BFKL if expanded out in powers of alpha to lowest order. Which you can see the one goes away, 1 plus 1 minus 1 minus 1, and what I got is I got differences of alphas at different points, so I have gradients. And these gradients combine this kernel to give me the standard BFKL kernel, which has, of course, no color neutrality. But now, assume that I go in a high energy regime where x perp minus y perp, the fixed external points, or I measure correlations at my dipole, x perp and y perp is my dipole. My dipole has a much larger size. So now you should change image. You should think about the dipole coming here to probe correlation, because that's what I'm about. We're thinking about correlations there, yes? It's not a small dipole, it's a large dipole as compared to the saturation scale. So assume that my dipole is such that his size, x minus y, is much larger than saturation length.
Smaller.
No, larger. This is not a. I want to measure the correlation within the black disk now. That was the question.
Okay.
Then, by looking at the infinite property of this kernel, I can immediately demonstrate that also the typical Z here for the leading contribution is such that not only X minus Y is large as compared to 1 over QS, but also X minus Z or Z minus Y. All the dipoles are large. And being large, they're close to the black disk limit. So this is zero, this is zero, this is zero. The Wilson line are rapidly oscillating and average away to zero. That's a physical picture. And in this regime, you generally only get the one. And you have a new kernel, not the BFKL one, the trivial one from this point of view. And this trivial kernel is just a, once you integrate over Z, one over Z, this is just the logarithm of X minus Y squared. This is one over K per squared in corner representation. So you need to be a distance is x minus y bigger than 1 over qs. That's all you need. Then that's 0, that's 0, that's 0, and you get quality neutrality.
How do I convince myself that not only x minus y is large, but also z minus y is large?
You have to look at this equation to realize that it has no infinite problems.
Okay.
Yes, that's all.
Other questions?
Yeah. Well, physically, the crucial assumption which you make is to characterize the evolution in
No, I proved that. No, I didn't make any approximation.
Once again, let's hear the question.
Of a B-dependent profile and S-dependent evolution.
You mean the initial condition?
Yes.
Yeah, that's trivial. That's D-glob. D-glob is local in B-perm. Sure.
Then in D-glob, usually, for example, you give this initial condition at some scale Q squared, which is around 1 J squared, at which you would think that it is reasonable to start with the cumulative evolution. Mm-hmm. Now, taking this tail in coordinate space, e to minus 2 and pi b, and starting evolution from this point, mm-hmm. is equivalent to saying that you start your evolution at the scale of 2 and pi. Because you have some non-perturbative physics which forms this exponential tail, and you say this physics is purely non-perturbative because it has finite mass.
Okay, but
the evolution in energy of this region, you say, is purely perturbative, and this is.
Yes, of course. I mean, I can only. I'm working in a leading logarithmic approximation in energy, so my equation only applies if the energy is high enough. So you may accuse that indeed I need factorization at a relatively high energy to start with. I agree, but that's a property at a reasonably large energy, not asymptotically large.
And what you're saying is that if the Poisson bound is satisfied at some very large energy, then you're showing it will be satisfied at all higher energies.
Exactly, that's the point.
That's what he's saying. He's not starting at a lower energy, he's starting at a high energy, and he's just assuming...
Well, high energy. High energy, where the norm, what equation like the Glapp and BFKL applies.
Yeah, yes. High enough that everything is... Yeah.
That linear evolution equation apply.
And you're saying that... If you hypothesize that the Poisson bound is satisfied at whatever high energy that is,
yes.
then what you've shown is it satisfies all high energies.
Yes, that's right.
Is that a good summary?
Yes, that's.
So, Dean, I'm not sure I understood what you said.
No.
You're not happy.
Yeah, I'm not happy because yeah, basically, you know. You have this, what everyone is saying is that at high energies, all physics is short distance. So it is eliminated by the physics of this saturation.
It's a way to say, yes, the evolution. Don't forget that I'm saying at the same time that the cross section is dominated by the black disk. By the way, that's a pictorial picture of the evolution of the black disk with increasing rapidity from tau second to tau prime to tau. So you see the black disk stands, there will be always a gray area around it. And the higher the energy, the width of the gray area remains constant, probably not obvious here, but it remains constant according to the equation we wrote, while the black disk extends larger and larger. And of course,
what's the dashed line?
It's a regime between different type of scalings. If you're close to the center, the energy, the saturation scale increases at the exponential of the rapidity, always. But the coefficient in front of the exponent of the rapidity. Let me show.
This gray disk is always non-perturbative.
The black disk is always non-perturbative. The gray is always perturbative. So let me answer Krishna's question. This coefficient here, omega, it's BFK intercept only at sufficiently large distances. So only the black disk is large enough. So if...
Come back to Dima's question.
Yes. So Dima's question, no, the black disk is saturated.
No,
yes.
My question is, you have this, you know, gray...
Right. That's BFKL, yes. Right.
So what I'm claiming is that this gray area will always remain non-perturbative at any energy.
Of course. No, you didn't get the clue. My dipole is Q squared, very large, around QCD. By definition, I have delimited the external edge of the hadron, that the distance from the center, RH of tau, at which the saturation scale locally becomes lambda QCD.
What's the thickness of the, what's the width of the gray?
I didn't say that. So this is a black disk radius, yes? At this scale, at the edge of the black disk, the local saturation scale is equal to Q squared, or the incoming dipole.
What's the width of the gray?
Okay, at each edge, it's local to lambda QCD squared. So this is the edge where the saturation scale locally goes from the high Q squared to lambda QCD squared.
You're saying the inner edge of the gray area is perturbative and the outer edge is where things
are. Perfectly, right, because my dipole is small. Of course, I never said that a dipole of order 1 of Q squared of order lambda QCD, I can say anything. But my dipole is so teeny, I am a high energy. I know the width of this area is 1/2 m π times log I of q squared over lambda qd squared.
So you discuss it to a certain bound for DIS, not
sure.
Hadron-Hadron
scale. Well, for any Hadron-Hadron as long as it's not pion.
For small dipole.
For small dipole. Then, of course.
It wouldn't work for large dipole.
Right? I agree, a priori, yes, of course.
No, if you are not claiming for a certain Hadron-Hadron scale, then I'm here.
Oh, it depends what is the typical color distribution. I mean, any Hadron is a collection of dipoles, of course.
Now I want to understand the claim again. So yes. Everything you're saying.
It was more in perturbative dipole.
This is all deep elastic scale.
Not even that. This is really small dipole. Even in deep elastic, we have the whole distribution.
No. I can vary. No. There is no problem. I know exactly how that distribution works, and I can make the calculation. That's well known since ever. This is Ribov. Let me ask Jamal. If you have the cross normal, that's the standard. If you have Poisson bound, for a dipole. You mean the cross-section of the dipole increases like log I'm squared of the energy. Then Ribot has shown, and that's very simple to show, that the total cross-section in deep elastic scattering goes like log I'm of S cubed. That I can show you by using wave function, no problem.
So,
it violates nothing. That's for deep elastic scattering, not for the Hadron-Hadron dipole. That's standard.
No,
that's 6T. Look at the integer.
There's no Poisson for deep
elastic? No, it is the Poisson bound is tau cubed. That's a consequence of Poisson bound for the dipole, which is non-trivial Hadron stuff, by the convolution of the photon wave function. You just make the calculation. All the papers say that. That's really standard.
What would you say for Hadron-Hadron scattering?
Well, assume that you have I cannot say anything about the pion Hadron scattering. I can see anything about quarkonium Hadron scattering, of course.
Proton-proton scattering.
I have no model for myself of one of the proton as being a collection of small dipoles. I cannot prove that it's just a collection of small dipoles. So I cannot prove.
What does Poisson say about?
Poisson doesn't care about dynamics. So he only cares about.
Statement. Poisson is about any hadronic interaction.
Sure.
And this is really only for small dipole.
Sure.
Scattering.
That's the only proof in any quantum field theory ever. Okay.
Okay. Your introduction. Your introduction said that any scattering cross section asymptotically grows like maximum like log.
That's Poisson, of course.
But you just said that your calculation gives for deep inelastic
for a small dipole
for the total deep inelastic
right.
Log cubed, which rises more rapidly than log squared.
Sure. Because Poisson was formulated with the argument for Hadron-Hadron scattering. It was only one part of the interaction. It was not the second part of the interaction, which is the perturbative coupling of the photon to the QQ bar pair. That gives one more integration over momenta, over scale of the Hadron scale of the QQ bar pair, and this gives one more energy.
Well, now I'm confused. Is there a common limit?
No.
Poisson limit for all sections?
No. It depends upon the process. No.
No. The point is in a deep inelastic scattering, the virtual photon is not in asymptotic state. So this is why, strictly speaking, you cannot apply Poisson to DIS, because virtual photon is not part of your asymptotic in or out state.
Yeah, I'm not so much expert in that, so probably Dima knows better the answer. But I just know that if I compute using saturated, Poisson-saturated dipole hadron cross-section.
So now I'm beginning to understand that what you guys seem to be saying is that having proven that for a small dipole doesn't prove yet anything. Because if I take an asymptotic state, hadronic state that's catalytic on another asymptotic hadronic state, mm-hmm. I first have to understand what's the distribution of small dipoles
yes.
in there.
Sure.
And have to
but that's valid for everything. That's valid not only.
Prove it for a small hadron on a big hadron.
Just take a quark, a bottomium scattering of a hadron. I prove everything then. So it depends upon the problem you look at. I mean, that's the first ever proof of Poisson bound in any quantum field theory, in a 5-4. Nobody ever proved it. So it's up to you how to look at it.
So let me ask a very naive question. I'm still not comfortable with my understanding of your claim of why getting a high density of color charges in this black disk so that Wilson lines average to zero is the same thing as actually getting color neutrality. So
it's not
just phrase it differently.
Yes.
Let me put aside all the real physics of QCD and just pretend that I had abelian system, I mean, ordinary QED type, where I just say a priori, in some volume, I've got some huge density of charges. And so everything you said about line intervals of the gauge field, I can carry over verbatim. But if I say my charges are just distributed randomly, I'll just have Poisson statistics for what the total charge and the volume is, and I certainly won't have charge neutrality. So where's the key difference?
Well, first of all, let me show that unfortunately, there is no QED analog, because all that evolution I showed to you before, it's only for, so to say, photon, coupled photons. It's for gluons. It does not, the equation do not remain the same. There is no leading log approximation if you want for quarks. Whenever you place one single gluon in a gluon cascade with a QQ bar pair, you not only don't have any log, but you lose one power of the energy. So the contribution of a QQ bar pair as compared to the contribution of a gluon line is smaller by log I one over x divided by the energy. So really, I don't know. I have no idea how to reformulate or to make the argument for QED.
So you're just saying it comes from actually just analyzing your Fokker-Planck equation
right.
in this limit.
Which is gluon dynamics by definition.
But in that limit, I mean, I understand you're saying I can drop the Wilson line terms, I can then simplify
right.
the kernel. I still didn't quite see how I got color neutrality out of it.
Well, why is intuitivity like that a priori? Well, it probably simply shows what? It simply shows that quantum evolution respects gauge symmetry. I mean, I start with a system of valence quarks, which I define as a distribution of color sources. This is an ad hoc initial assumption, which means there is no correlation among these valence quarks. But then I let them radiate more and more and more. And I go to higher energy, meaning to smaller and smaller x on the gluon cascade. This means as if my k-perp is more than q-saturation, I'm not seeing the high k-perp, I do not see my initial sources any longer. I do not see my initial gluon charge distribution, which of course, no doubt, that initial charge distribution has no color neutrality by construction. It's just randomly distributed. But if I look at very small k-perp, my external probe only overlaps with those small k-perp as itself. So if my external small k-perp is as small k-perp as those of the saturated gluon, this saturated gluon are only radiative products. And they have been radiated according to rules of QCD. So my claim is the following. Let's look at my equation. It's rho proportional to k squared. Doesn't recall you, but that any gauge invariant charge colorator has to behave like that. Of course, the initial condition was not like that because it was enforcing to have color charge there. My quantum evolution eventually brings me to the point where my correlation, charge correlation, has the expected k-square behavior. And that's as far as I have to see more. I mean, that's very new also for us as a result.
Strictly speaking, this isolating Wilson lines only tell you that fluctuations in color charge become small at very high density, but it doesn't tell you that.
Sure, no, that's a mean field approximation, if you want. I agree. Yeah. You have
a what approximation?
A kind of mean field approximation, because
you're not saying in an area of order QS,
yes.
One over QS.
Yes, so total charge is zero.
You're not saying you're saying that there's many random color charges. So
correlated, not random, correlated. In such a way that Q squared is zero, not Q is zero.
Are you saying it's a color singlet?
Yes. No. Dipole is non zero.
Yes,
you're not. No confinement. It's not confinement. No. Sure. No. How could I have confinement?
Right.
I have just no monopole charge. That's all.
Okay. So you're saying there's no monopole charge.
That's all I think. That's all enough. That will give me the dipole interactions. That's why I have one before, so not exponential.
It's more neutral than it would be if I just picked a bunch of random charges. Because
sure.
A bunch of random charges would have a monopole charge would be like 1 over root n, where n is the number of charges.
Right.
And you're saying that 1 over root, you know, the monopole charge of order 1 over root n isn't there.
No, because these charges are correlated, that's right. Over a distance 1 over qs.
Now, the components, the transverse components of the gauge field are supposed to be negligible, or all of this is in some gauge where they're sufficiently smooth?
No.
The question is being asked is a slippery question if I have a non-perturbatively large gauge field.
It is the field that's strong, 1 over g, in this regime. Because
in what directions, or in all directions?
It depends upon the gauge fixing. If you're on a Lacon gauge, so if a plus is 0, then ai, the transverse field, is 1 over g. If you're in the, yes? So
then I'm completely confused about
no, but
your what we've just been talking about.
The Wiesel lines.
How do I add up charges within an area? I mean, or rather, why can't I get whatever answer I want, just depending on what gauge I do that exercise
in? No, the definition of the charge density is gauge invariant. I mean,
the charge density is gauge covariant.
And gauge covariant, yes.
Over an area does not give you a gauge invariant thing. Because you have to transport it from one place to another.
Oh, sure. But I had the transport problems in it. So whenever I mean, this definition with rho, it's right in some gauge. In other gauge, I have transport problems. I have power transport in it.
That's what I want to understand. So sure. What gauge am I supposed to think of for this to be simple?
The thing is simple in the gauge, in the covariant gauge. In that gauge, the following equation. With rho independent of time. Let me make a general statement. In any gauge, in a fixed given gauge, this Jan-Mills problem has only one independent field degrees of freedom. One. I can go to the Lycon, to the covariant gauge, and in this covariant gauge, this degrees of freedom becomes explicit. It's A plus. And I call it a tilde to be covariant gauge. A plus, which I call alpha in my calculations. In this gauge, in the covariant gauge, I have only one field, which is a plus component. If I go to the Lycon gauge, no tilde, then the unique degree of freedom is the group element out of which I can construct the AIs. Means I have A1 and 2, which is V, VI, V Dagger. But it's only one V. And going from here to that is just a gauge rotation. That's why my V Dagger is part of the exponential of alpha. So my alpha in all the formula was a covariant gauge field. But physical quantities like the Parton number density is given in terms of AIs. So that's when I compute a two-point function of AI, in fact, I compute in really a correlation function of Wilson lines.
So let's break. Yeah, I think we should.
One quick question. Since your correlation length is 1 over QS, if I calculated the correlator of AI, not Wilson lines, just AI in the slide point.
It's a gluon distribution. Yes.
Sure. Then I should see effective mass for gluon.
No, it's not color singlet. It's just no color charge, not the same. That's the point. I don't need any. I mean, the claim by Kovner-Wieland was as following. Unless you replace in the BFKL kernel the power law, standard power law, it's my famous equation. Anyway, I mean, that's pretty much the equation, which has, right. The claim by Kovner-Wieland was the following. Unless you replace this is the Coulomb propagator here. It's the electric field in two dimensions. You see, that's the derivative of the log. So this is the propagator of electric field in two dimensions. Unless if you replace the propagator of the massless electric field by a Weakawa field, a mass here for the fluctuation integrate over, unless you do that, they say you never get faster about. That's wrong. I don't need color singlet. I don't need mass for the photon. My gluon is as massless as Elvis, always. It's perturbative.
Yes, thank you, Mario.
Thank you, and sorry for